You're listening to The Drew Marshall Show, Canada's most listened to spiritual talkback program.
Well, folks, Michael Korn is host of the nightly Michael Korn Show, aptly named, on CTS Television, a weekly columnist published every Saturday with the Toronto, Ottawa, Calgary, Edmonton, and Winnipeg Sun, and London Free Press, and in more than a dozen other daily and weekly newspapers across Canada. He's also a columnist for Women's Post, the Catholic Register, The Landowner, and The Interim. But yeah, I hope this is all up to date. I got it off of his website. He is the best. I mean, how can one guy do all this? He's the best-selling author of 12 books, including biographies of G.K. Chesterton, brilliant, H.G. Wells, Arthur Conan Doyle, J.R.R. Tolkien, and C.S. Lewis. He has contributed to the Dictionary of National Biography and several other anthologies. He has published in many countries and in more than a dozen languages. In 2005, he won the Edward R. Murrow Award for Radio Broadcasting in 2006. Didn't the guy from WKRP win that?
No, that was the...
Les Nessman?
That was the Buckeye, Silver Sow.
No, that was the Buckeye Newshawk Award.
It was Silver Sow,
it?
Copper Cob, right. And Buckeye Newshawk.
Anyway, the list goes on, and really, the reason he's on the show today, folks, is because I just spent a month in Israel, and there's a lot to process, I'm still decompressing, and there was only one guy I wanted to do that with, and it's this gentleman, Michael Korn, on the Drew Marshall Show. G'day, mate, how you going?
That's pretty impressive, I've done all that stuff, my God.
Seriously. Well done, well done. The last time you and I saw each other, we were sitting in some seats on a CBC studio doing Test the Nation, and I think we lost because I was on the team.
No, that's not why we lost, but whether we won or lost, remember, the public had to pay for that, so all of your listeners should be very happy that their tax dollars went to make sure the CBC had a bit of fun around New Year.
Oh, my goodness. I don't know if any... Have you ever sat down for 2 hours and watched a show similar to that? 2 hours.
To be honest, I've never watched anything on the CBC for more than 5 minutes.
Right.
But, although I do particularly enjoy Little Mosque on the Prairie because it tells me that all Muslims are peace-loving, beautiful people and Christians are bigoted white idiots. I need to know this and I'm glad I'm paying for it.
You kill me. Tariq Fatah, I had him on the show a while back. Well, it was in December. And boy, I enjoyed him. Now, I know he's coming up again. He's a regular on your show. He's coming up in the next couple of weeks, is he not?
Every Monday we have him on. An old friend and a great man, and one of the bravest people, one of the bravest public intellectuals we have in North America, actually.
Does he take a lot of flack? I reckon he does.
Yeah, he does. He's not a very big guy, but he's got a huge amount of courage. He's very brave, and he gets death threats, he's abused, and so on. But, I mean, we're all used to that, of course, but with Tariq, he's facing a community that has... with all due respect, a history of sometimes carrying out these threats. So he's a brave man.
And you also spent a fair bit of time with Irshad Manji. And, of course, she's gone down to, is it New York, I think? Is she's doing some stuff in the States now?
Yeah, I haven't seen Irshad in a while. For 2 years, we did a TV show together. And, again, she's terrific. But I see Tariq once or twice a week. I haven't seen Irshad in probably more than a year.
Right. Well, Michael, I really don't know how to process this month in Israel. I've said this to people. It's like a married couple who have been in deep trouble for a while going away for a marriage counseling weekend. The therapist out there will tell you that's not a good move. You got to work on some other things before you hyper-focus on the issues you're currently experiencing. Me going to Israel in the middle of a crisis of faith did not help me in the slightest.
Who has the crisis of faith, you or Israel?
Yeah, well said. Yeah, nice. Nice.
It's an amazing country to visit because it's multi-layered. And you have both the current political climate and the challenges, and you have the whole of history. And as you know, they probably took you to these places, tells, where there's layers of history. And you can actually go back through 500 years ago, 1,000, 2,000, 5,000. And every one of those has bearing on modern Israel. So it depends, I suppose, which one you want to process, the Christian experience, the Jewish, the post-1948. It's very complex.
I just asked Frank Schaefer if the states will ever stop sucking up to the Jews. Poorly worded?
probably the wrong person to ask as well. It's interesting about the history of modern Israel, the rebirth of Israel in 1948, that it's very fashionable to say that America's always backed Israel. That's completely untrue.
Okay.
In 1948, it was the Soviets who backed Israel. In fact, most of the arms came from Czechoslovakia. In 1967, it was the French. It was Mirage jets and British Centurions, old ones that they used. It was only in 1973 that America really took sides in this issue. In 1956, in the Suez War, it was Britain, France, and Israel that went into Egypt. It was the Americans who forced all three of those powers to stop, threatened to bankrupt the British economy. So America got involved when the Cold War hit the Middle East. The Soviets went into Egypt, effectively, and the Americans back to Israel. But until then, it had been pretty neutral. Initially, Israel was seen, a lot of the Jewish founders of modern Israel were left-wing, and the Soviets thought they would have an ally in the region. So, again, it's nuanced, but today a lot of anti-Israel feeling comes from people who want to attack the U.S. vicariously. I mean, there is no doubt, the question you asked, that there's a Jewish lobby in the United States, and Jewish people have influence, but then anyone is entitled to try and get influence, and they either achieve it or they don't.
But is it really connected with this sort of eschatological end times, we better be tight with the Jews because that's what God wants?
No, I don't know. Hardly, Barack Obama is hardly a fundamentalist Christian. And no, I don't think so at all. George Bush's father was not really an evangelical Christian. I would say he was more, on many areas, a liberal Protestant. Ronald Reagan, I wouldn't think, would fit that bill. No, I don't think so at all. I mean, obviously, there are Christian Zionists in Canada and the USA, in principally, who very much support Israel from a biblical standpoint. But there are many other people, and there's nothing wrong with that. But most Christians I know who support Israel do so out of a post-Holocaust theology. They believe that the world does owe the Jewish people a safe homeland. I know that, that some people like to paint Christians as being these fanatical, Israel can do no wrong. But the fanaticism I've seen, in fact, is from more liberal people who think that Israel can do no right, and so everything has to be pro-Palestinian, which is equally ridiculous.
Okay, I remember traveling through the West Bank, or we stayed in the West Bank for a little bit. We were at a major square, Christmas Eve. Mm-hmm. We had, of course, our local people that took us here, took us there. They tried to stay away from an agenda in their conversation, but when I pulled one gentleman aside and said, let's shoot straight, this was a Muslim man, and he took me into one of the ghettos inside the West Bank and began his, I guess, dissection of why this was. And this is, you know, Michael, I've stayed away from Middle East stuff because I'm ignorant, and I defer to you many times. You know, if somebody has a big question about this, go to Michael. But from what I understand, Israel is stealing land and kicking out Palestinian people from their homes. Yes or no? True or false?
You can't give a one-word answer to such a complex question. Now, in the West Bank, there's a lot of space in the West Bank. It depends what you're referring to. From a directly Christian point of view, there's a hemorrhaging of Christians from the West Bank. Now, without any doubt, Israel destabilized the region when it was recreated, but at the same time, if you ask any Christian what it's like living in a Muslim-dominated area of the West Bank, let alone Gaza, which is far worse, they will tell you they're denied jobs, even if they're better qualified. They face social persecution. This is why they're leaving. Now, many of them will not say this while they're there, because they're frightened. Look, Israel was given territory in 1948, some of which it lost and some it gained. Because as soon as the United Nations, no one else, not the Americans, the United Nations voted to give the Jewish people this homeland, which, of course, had been theirs. I mean, they were there long before anyone else. I mean, I suppose you can say that the Canaanites were there before them, but they're not making a land claim at this point. They're gone.
Right.
So the Romans, AD 70, and the revolt in the early 2nd century, there were always Jews there. They weren't allowed to live in Jerusalem. Some stay, they managed to. And then Crusaders came in, destroyed synagogues in the 11th and 12th century. Muslim armies invading. But Jews have always been there. I mean, Jews were massacred as late as 1929 by Muslims in the Holy Land. But the UN gave them a homeland. Some of the land they lost. All of the Arab countries invaded. Not one Arab country was willing to say we accept the UN ruling. People forget that now. Those Arab leaders who were assassinated immediately, such as the King of Jordan, by radicals. And since then, Israel's fought for what it's had. Now, if at any time, and I'm not a fool, I understand both sides can be dishonest here, but if at any time in that period the Arab countries have said, look, we don't particularly like you, we don't particularly want you here, but you're here, the UN says yes, here's your country, we will recognize you, let's live in peace. But that was never offered. And 1967, the Egyptians are putting up a massive army Not that Nasser wanted to, in fact. He actually was quite ambivalent towards Israel, but there were radicals who were forcing him to. And then Israel responded. They said, we're not going to wait to be invaded. We're going to take you. And they did. In 73, on Yom Kippur, by the way, did you notice how the RCMP apologized for some Muslim potential terrorists being arrested on Ramadan? Well, in Yom Kippur, the Arab armies invaded, and they did quite well for the first week, and then Israel managed to get the upper hand. And so they got more land. You know, Israel keeps winning these wars, and the mentality of the world is, oh, okay, you got that one, but now give all the land back. Well, they gave back almost the entire Sinai Desert to Egypt. There's a huge amount of land. They gave all that back. They're even willing, and I don't know if I would agree with it, to give the Golan Heights back if Syria will really make proper peace.
But wow.
I don't know if you, I mean, the problem here is the Palestinians are suffering. There's no doubt of that. They're despised by most of the Arab world. They don't believe the lies of Muslim Brotherhood. It's simply not true.
Really?
Oh, golly. I mean, I've seen, I mean, the Sunni Shia violence right now. Right now, in Pakistan, they are murdering each other. In Yemen, Saudi aircraft bombing Shia militia. Sunni Muslims in Iran denied even a mosque in a major city throughout the Persian region. Within their own, within Sunni, within Shia Islam, the sort of atrocities that do take place. The way that Bangladeshi workers are treated in Gulf states. I mean, this goes on and on and on. So how do we solve the Palestinian issue? It's very, very difficult. I'm not even sure if it's entirely possible now. There are people who say Jordan should be made a Palestinian state. It really is the homeland, I suppose, of the Palestinians. The problems we face are many. There were a very limited number of Palestinians who, without doubt, did lose their land in 1948. There are now millions who claim that they lost their land. It's simply not true. Any supporter of Israel who says, no one left, they left voluntarily if they did, and no, there were Palestinians who were chased out. There were Palestinians who were advised to leave. Whatever happened, they lost their land. Now, we have to either compensate or make sure these people are treated properly. But at the same time, these things do happen in history. There are many refugee populations, and you have Hamas now that believe that no Jew really should be living in the region. You have terrible persecution of Christians. No one believes for a moment that Jews will be treated properly under an Islamic regime, which is what it would be in Palestine. So it's a pretty bloody future.
Michael Korn on the Drew Marshall Show. I'm thinking back to my month there, Church of the Holy Sepulchre, walking around the various holy sites. Now, this is going to be a snapshot that I took away from this trip, and I want your commentary on my commentary. So bear with me for a second. It seems to me, like an ignorant white Western guy, having spent a month in Israel, that the various Christian denominations that are ruling the roost over there, whether they be the Coptic or the Catholic or the Orthodox or whatever, as well as the Muslims, it seems like everybody is trying to squat over an apparently site where Jesus apparently did this, that, or the other, and claim turf and jostle each other out of position. Am I missing something? Because that's, I mean, even the Christmas Day celebration in Manger Square, I was watching it on the television. I was staying in the same hotel as the Palestinian president. And I was watching the religious leaders jostle for position. And I know it's a cultural thing, and over there they're always jostling. And, you know, no one knows how to use a line up over there, a Q. They don't even know how to spell Q. But it seems to me that it is the pinnacle of religious BS.
Well, I've never been in Manger Square at Christmas, but I do know the Holy Sepulchre quite well, actually. The problem there is that you have effectively seven denominations who control it. And I have to say this, and I'm sure some people will be upset, but the Orthodox, the Eastern Orthodox churches in the Holy Land have not always been prime examples of the Christian life. And there's no Protestant control over the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, but the Roman Catholic Church is there, and I think the Roman Catholic Church Germany has acted very well. But some of the Orthodox churches are very ethnically based. They're quite insecure about their position there. And there have been cases, and it's horribly embarrassing, where Israeli soldiers and police have had to go in to stop fist fights between groups of monks from rival Orthodox denominations.
Wow.
I remember being there.
It's like a bad scene from a Monty Python sketch.
Well, it really is. her being there for Mass at about 5 in the morning, 5:30 in the morning, and as soon as the most important part of the Mass began, Orthodox monks just behind us, and you know how close everything is,
yes, yes,
5 yards, began chanting as loudly as they could. My eyes caught those of a nun who was in the congregation. She gave me this quite lovely smile. They know what's happening. It's very crude triumphalism, really. And there should be some agreement. There isn't. This is the East. It's crowded. It's smelly. It's Oriental, if you like. I find that quite delicious, actually. I find it's very real. I think it's a world that Jesus would have been far more familiar with than a neatly organized shopping mall in suburban Toronto.
Right. Yeah. Another disturbing aspect of my time there was Christmas Eve, Manger Square. They were having some shocking presentations on stage, much like a little church in the suburbs. And I thought, come on, it's Manger Square. Ramp it up a little bit here. But then all of a sudden, Dr. Marilyn Hickey came on. Are you familiar with her?
No, I'm afraid not.
You're not losing much there. She came on and she began with this, American, evangelist, a prosperity hair, Jack to Jesus, TBN network kind of gal. Jesus is the answer to all of your financial problems.
Ooh, dear.
Now, saying this to in Manger Square on Christmas Eve, 90% Muslim men under the age of 30.
Yeah.
now, as soon as she launched into that... She was about 10 minutes into her spiel, and then as soon as she launched into the prosperity stuff, the Muslim prayer tower or turret behind me, they started with their call to prayer. And I almost rolled on the ground laughing at this ridiculous moment.
I haven't seen that. Certainly, Christians in the Holy Land, including in the West Bank, and of course this is political too, and you tend to support the community that you spend time with. So... And there's a war going on, a propaganda war. So Christians who go there and spend time with Palestinians tend to be more pro-Palestinian, and those who spend time with Israeli Jews
right.
tend to be more pro-Israeli.
Right.
But I think the Franciscans do a very good job. I think many evangelicals do a very fine job there. But you mentioned the call to prayer, something else, and this is in Israel proper, in Nazareth, in the north of the country, which has very limited significance to Muslims, but of course a great deal to Christians. The Muslims were insistent they should build a mosque that was higher than the church, and eventually it was stopped. But see, this is the added dimension. You have a new Islamic triumphalism and a radicalism
mm-hmm.
that is beginning to dominate the region, and just recently outside of Israel, but we've had in Egypt, in Iraq, and so on, we've had terrible slaughters of Christian people. So it's not just about Israel-Palestine. That's almost incidental, actually.
A Holocaust Memorial. You've been there, the one in Jerusalem?
In Yad Vashem, yeah, many times, yeah.
I was bowled over. I was ambushed by my emotions. I get an idea of what it's going to be like. I walk in, I experience it, and I walked out, sat on a rock, and fell apart. You know, I don't know where you're at theologically, spiritually these days, but, you know, for someone who's in the middle of this where the heck are you even real God moment in life, where were you in all of this? 6 million, come on. And, I was just overwhelmed.
Yeah, well, I've been there many times. It's actually the new one. The old one wasn't, it was moving, but not quite as, I suppose, impressive as it is now. At its most crass, my response would be, so what?
Yeah.
7 million Ukrainians, 6 million Jews, millions of Chinese. I mean, it goes on and on, slaughter.
Sure.
That, for me, though, is a problem for the atheist, not for the Christian. I know that real life hasn't begun yet. This is merely the land of shadows, that at death, that is when we see that the magnitude of the greatness of existence. If you really think that life ends when our bodies decay, when they're finished, when the heart stops pumping, then I think mass suffering, like the obscenity of the Holocaust, is a real challenge for you. But I don't believe that. I believe that God, however painful, and my father was Jewish, his family came from Poland. I mean, certainly there was a strong consciousness of that suffering, but I don't think that questions God. I mean, you may know this, that there are some Orthodox Jews who actually believe that the Holocaust was a divine punishment. Now, if you say that, of course, to some audiences, they get very, very upset. It's not me saying it.
Yeah.
I don't believe it. But there are some Orthodox Jews who do argue that this was punishment because the Jewish people were not following God enough. That's another issue. But I don't believe it says anything about God's love. I think it says everything about human evil and the influence of those who do not embrace God.
Well, someone very wisely said to me, well, Drew, think about this. God didn't intervene when 6 million Jews were being annihilated. Why should he intervene with you and your little sucky crisis of faith thing?
I didn't know about your crisis of faith. So now come on, my son. How can I help you?
Yes. You know, one of the first times I came back from Australia and I heard you on the radio, and I thought there's something different about this guy. And I guess, you know, your faith was rocking and rolling at the time or whatever. And I phoned you up out of the blue and I just said, well done. I just, you know, there's something about you. I heard it. It's different. Okay, I get that. And then a few years go by. I jump into the radio thing. I'm still listening to you. You're a bit of a mentor in some ways. And then I know that's scary, isn't it?
Yeah.
You jump ship. You go from evangelicalism to Catholicism, back to Catholicism, if I understand things right.
Well, I wouldn't say jump ship, but yeah, I was received into the Roman Catholic Church in 1985, I think it would have been. I was still in the UK at that point. And then I came to Canada. I'll tell you what happened. I was giving a lecture at the University of Toronto in 1986, and a very boring lecture, frankly. But at the end of it, a woman came up to me and she said, "You're amazing." And thinking this may never happen again, I married her. And I was completely correct. It's never happened again.
Yes. But prophetic, very prophetic.
Exactly. So I came to Canada, and I came into a very different Catholic church, and it was very, it was going through a difficult time, very questioning and very liberal, if you forgive the word. It's not fully descriptive. And I didn't hear Jesus mentioned that often. I heard all sorts of other things. And I drifted away, and but you can't drift away for long. There's a twitch upon the thread, and I wanted Christ. And so when I came back to really believe, you know, not I never didn't believe, but when I came back to wanting to worship, I thought, well, it has to be evangelical, because this is I can't go back to the Catholic Church, and it's the closest way. So for some years, I worshipped as an evangelical, a period I'm very grateful for. But finally, about six years ago, I did come back to the Catholic Church.
Why?
Oh, golly, I don't want to be sectarian here, because I mean, I've always said that what unites... Now, this is a distinction now. I don't think it's any longer so much between Catholic and Protestant. It's between serious Christian and pretend Christian. If you are an evangelical, if you're a serious Catholic, if you're a devoted follower of Eastern Orthodoxy, you have differences, but what unites you is enormous. What separates you from the secular world and from liberal Christians is huge. So we have so much in common. We think about the battles we've fought socially on issues of life and sexuality and family values. We believe Christ, born of a virgin, son of God, dies for our sins, faith and relationship in and with him, we're given eternal life. We agree on that. If that's pretty big. For me, it was really the sacraments. I do believe that the body and blood of Christ is there on the altar, the Eucharist. I believe that. I believe in the sacraments of the church. I do believe that Jesus left us a church and a teaching office, not a Bible. I mean, this is a fundamental point of disagreement. I believe in the complete truth of Scripture, but I also believe that we have a magisterium, a teaching office to interpret for us. Was the evangelical position, which I respect enormously, but it would be that we will have the heart and the mind to interpret Scripture individually, and so we disagree on that.
Okay, as a good Catholic boy, Man U, what's going on with them?
It's not a Catholic team. Now Celtic's a Catholic team.
I know. I wanted some venom to come out of your mouth, you know. And
well, it's very hard for me because my youngest son is a big Manchester United fan. You see, So it's quite difficult. Well, they're doing quite well, Man United. They're playing Liverpool tomorrow in the FA Cup.
Right.
Liverpool's a huge crisis. That's going to be a big problem. I'm a Tottenham fan.
Right. That's right. That's right.
And Tottenham's a Jewish team.
Wow.
Did you know that?
No, I had no idea.
Oh, if you listen, it's the area of London it's in, but also if you look at the crowd, you'll see some Israeli flags. But if you actually listen to what they're chanting, I'm not going to say it on your show, the word, but if you listen to the chant sometimes, the word is not what some people think.
Right.
But no, I'm a Tottenham fan, born and bred.
You know, I just can't imagine there ever being a Jewish Sports Hall of Fame.
You'd be very surprised. Well, I tell you, you mentioned Israel. What you have now, of course, is that there are so many Israelis who are playing professional sport. There's half a dozen in the English Premiership. David Beckham has a Jewish grandfather. But there's a lot of Israelis playing now. And in sports like judo, they're very, very big. And, but in soccer,
there's
really
a joke there somewhere.
Yeah, I know there is. But I think it means the gentle way in Japanese.
Right. You know, my best FA Cup story, I'll share this with briefly. I was, maybe I shouldn't, but I will. I was associate pastor at a church in the Blue Mountains. I was there for about 3 months. Someone handed me an announcement to mention during the service. I was rushed. I put it in the stack of announcements. No worries. Here we go. It's announcement time. I come out and I say, and I read it. This is what the announcement said. At 7:30, all the young adults are going to go over to the Logan's house to watch the FA Cup. Well, you know what the FA Cup is, but I didn't. I was not a football or soccer fan. I did not know that. Yes. You know, exactly. So I said,
how long did you laugh?
I put the F and the A together, and the rest is history, they say.
That's very, very good. Yeah. Well, there are some games today, but tomorrow is Tottenham are playing and Manchester United, Liverpool.
In wrapping this up in my debrief, coming back from a month in Israel, filming this little documentary thing, the word desperation came to me. Whether it be as obvious as shoving prayer notes in every crack and orifice and hole that people can find, whether it's at the Church of Annunciation or the Holy Sepulchre or anywhere, of course, the Western Wall. Desperation, the melted candles, the kissing of somebody's ring, the offering of money, the money down at the well of Mary's well, where she apparently drank from, or whatever. There just seem, and I guess it's worldwide. We yearn for the thinning, that chasm between us and the Almighty, and there just seems to be a massive spiritual desperation there.
Well, these are just outward gestures of internal or inner faith. Now, sometimes to a Westerner, they seem to be vulgar. But then I think there are aspects of Western Christianity that would be embarrassing.
Far more vulgar.
Yeah, to people in the East. I mean, I am sometimes uncomfortable with aspects of worship in the Holy Land, because it is, as I say, very Eastern. I have a CD of Christmas music from the Holy Land, and it seems very alien to me. I'm used to hearing hymns or medieval carols, and what I'm hearing here is something which is very strange to my ears, but it would have been far more familiar to Jesus, I would think. So I don't know if that's desperation. And it can seem... you probably went to the Garden Tomb as well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's very interesting, because the Garden Tomb is not where it happened. There is overwhelming archaeological evidence that the Holy Sepulchre is the place. But a lot of people feel much more comfortable at the Garden Tomb because it's quiet and subdued and elegant. And you can see, it's not even of the period, but it's a wonderful illustration of what it would have looked like. Whereas the Holy Sepulchre is built over. So it's where you find your comfort zone.
Did you realize how many people are not aware that Golgotha is inside a church?
Probably not. And the reason, of course, is because you had to protect it. And you had to honor it. But it's very difficult in a very, very dark space to think to yourself, well, this, of course, was out in the open. This was outside the walls. And this is what happened here. And, of course, that huge silver crucifix as you go up the stairs.
Right.
And you think, this is not... Like, for me, going to a medieval church in the middle of the English countryside is as close to Christianity as I can possibly imagine. But what relevance does that have to someone in the middle of Africa or the Sinai Desert or Jerusalem?
Right.
So I suppose it's very hard for us to get out of those cultural boundaries.
But they're lining up, they're bending down at the altar, they're kissing whatever they can kiss, they shove their hand down that hole in the marble and touch the actual rock, and then you can look over the balcony, you look down in the marble slab where apparently they wrap Jesus in the burial cloth, and then just past that is the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea, which I don't think was anywhere near that close to Golgotha.
No. And the slab is probably not.
No.
But the place of crucifixion and the place of the tomb, any archaeologist worth his salt who I've read said these are genuine. But the thing about the slab where they're supposed to have dressed the body, it probably isn't the place, but it's soaked in prayer. And the precedent of so many people praying to God at that spot, I think, makes it rather holy.
But did you not feel like standing on that balcony and yelling out at everybody, look, people, did you not get the memo? Jesus isn't actually here. He's not.
That's fundamental to their faith. And then there are some people who, that's the end of their faith. Of course, and it shouldn't be. What faith is, it happened here, but he's no longer with us. Look. If you find the body of Jesus, it's all over.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think it was a Garden Tomb. It was the Holy Sepulchre. But the most important conclusion, though, is he's not here now, of course. He's with everyone for all time. But the resurrection is vital. The resurrection without the crucifixion, wrong. That's just silly and fluffy. The crucifixion without the resurrection, that's too morbid. It's both together that compose our faith.
Well, being, again, the white boy living in Wonderbread land up here who visited the Holy Land and was assaulted at every turning corner with just enormous amounts of incense and whatever else is being burned, and the religious paradigms that I'm not used to.
You're not, but imagine Jesus in the temple. The blood from the animal sacrifices, huge amounts of blood, the stink of animals being slaughtered, people that selling animals for sacrifice.
And the incense was covering that up.
He didn't object to animals being sold for sacrifice. He objected to animals that were bruised and not appropriate to God's honor.
Right.
Being
set.
You think of pagan incense. You think of the screaming and the shouting of Semitic people arguing with each other about what is really true. You think about Roman soldiers. You think about Jewish soldiers and the Sanhedrin. What you see today, as disturbing as it is to someone from Toronto or London or Sydney or wherever, it probably is more like the land that Jesus saw than anything else. So it's always worth remembering that.
Well, I guess my only conclusion in all of this is, I mean, I would not recommend anybody, if they're trying to find God, I don't think, the Middle East is the wrong place to go.
Did you sleep out in the desert ever?
Yeah, we slept in a Bedouin tent during the worst sandstorm in 42 years.
there are some monasteries in the desert.
Oh, I'd like to go to those places. That one tucked down in the side of the cliff, I can't remember where that was.
Oh, that's
just outside of Jerusalem.
Right, there's also one in Sinai, which is, in fact, there's a, you were in Australia, and there's an Australian Greek Orthodox monk who's quite prominent there. But there are places you can go. I mean, the built-up centers of the holy places are difficult, I agree with you on that. But to walk along the Sea of Galilee and have no one else with you, which is quite easy to achieve, that's when you can really feel something.
Yeah, unfortunately, I had two cameras, an audio man, and some other people with me everywhere I went. So it was frustrating, to say the least. Do you think my spiritual worries will be resolved should I sign on the dotted Catholic line?
I would never, especially on such a show. I think that the Christian line is the most important. But listen, you're an intelligent thinking man, and so having questions, that's a good thing. That doesn't mean you don't believe, but to fight. I mean, within Jewish belief, Orthodox Jewish belief, this constant discussion, this debate with God, that isn't a bad thing. And when we're first converted, it's euphoria. We just want to go out there and grab people and tell them how wonderful it all is. Then after a while, God puts us down. You're on your own now. I mean, I'm here, but now you have to do some thinking yourself. And so, of course, it's challenging. We meet hypocrisy. We meet hard times. Anyone who wakes up every morning and just says, oh, this is wonderful, is probably not going to be my friend for too long.
No.
I'm a cynic. But that's okay. And all sorts of people, I mean, he knows.
Yeah.
So it's all there. He does understand this. You're not the first person to question their faith.
Yeah. Well, look, I appreciate you. This is going to sound, this is usually opposite to how I research somebody. Usually when someone says something about someone to me, I take it with a grain of salt. But so many people I know who I like and appreciate and admire have said so many wonderful things about you that I just had to keep pursuing you to get you on my show.
They were either drunk or I'd bribe them.
Yes, one or the other.
It'll be any time. It'll always be a pleasure. I mean, particularly by phone, because with this weather. But no, I'd love to. It's been great fun.
Mate, thank you.
All right, take care of yourself.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Michael Korn on the Drew Marshall Show. That's been 7 years overdue. That's when I first pitched him, 7 years ago. And, it's good to have him. Good to have him. Have a little listen to this song. This is David Wilcox's song, Three Brothers. An incredible story about three sons who think that each of them have the right to the father's inheritance entirely. It has to do with three monotheistic beliefs landing on the same rock over in the Middle East. Phenomenal song. We'll be right back.
All three feel that they're the favorites. He loves each of them the best. And these documents he gave them will now put them to the test. So they open all the writings that will prove the rightful heir to this home that they remember, and the right to settle there. Their own sister is a prisoner, not see her face to face. They've not heard her song of beauty, felt the movement of her grace.